Did we say that we were going to do, we were going to take a public comment on?
I thought you were going to do the amendments.
Trying to remember where we left things this morning. Were we going to take up public comment on HB 36? Is that what I said this morning? We were going to finish a public comment on HB 36 and then go to the amendments on HB 9 and then come back to 36. That's right. Thank you for reminding me. I'd forgotten. Okay, so we have HB 36 before us, and we want to conclude public testimony on HB 36. We have two folks from APOC and Jason Bruni from RDC and Janine St. John from the Alliance. Thanks for jogging my memory, Jason. If you want to offer us your testimony, we appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, if you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation, you bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I am the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. I'm here today to testify in support of HB 36. RDC is a statewide, nonprofit, membership-funded organization founded in 1975. The RDC membership is comprised of individuals and companies from Alaska's oil and gas, mining, timber, tourism, and fisheries industries, as well as Alaska Native corporations, local communities, organized labor, and industry support firms. RDC's purpose is to link these diverse interests together to encourage a strong, diversified private sector in Alaska and expand the state's economic base through the responsible development of our natural resources. Although we sometimes may question the appropriateness and the role of the petition process as a means of governing, RDC appreciates the democratic rights of Alaskans to change state law through the initiative process. However, as we have seen over the last several years, a number of proposed initiatives have been brought forward that do not have the best interest of the state nor its people in mind. Furthermore, tactics are often used in the signature gathering process that mislead the public and misconstrue the issues and impacts at play. RDC believes that openness and transparency must be at the forefront of good government. This bill will require both public and legislative hearings for initiatives. This, frankly, is a good idea. The process each of you as legislators go through to pass laws is extremely thorough. Unintended consequences of a piece of legislation are usually vetted through the numerous committee hearings, public testimony, and floor debates that a bill requires. Each of you who generously give of your time to make laws for this great state are required to disclose how you raise money and how you spend money. Why shouldn't we hold those who are attempting to change state law through the initiative process to that same standard? And why wouldn't we make them disclose the source of their funds while they are collecting 30,000 plus signatures statewide? This openness and transparency will bring into the light of day the agendas, hidden or not, of the initiative sponsors. In response to Representative Lynn's question from this morning, we very much would oppose an amendment that prohibits foreign, quote, foreign contributions to this process. There is a large number of these so-called, quote, foreign companies that invest in Alaska, that employ Alaskans, be it in the oil and gas sector, mining, fisheries, tourism, etc. By doing business in Alaska, they demonstrate that they have a dog in this fight, and they should be allowed to participate in the process. If I could encourage you to add a different amendment, it would be to require signature gatherers to tell the truth. Sadly, this does not always occur. Let's take the cruise ship initiative, for example. Many petition signers were told this issue was a head tax. It clearly was much more than that, which has been demonstrated by the fact that since its passage, the legislature has already passed two laws to clean up items that were not, quote, head tax related. Amazingly, initiative signature gatherers aren't even required to carry the complete initiative with them. HB 36 would put that requirement in place. We must bring openness and transparency back to this process. HB 36 will also limit signature gatherers to only collecting signatures for one initiative at a time. I have seen personally signature gatherers blur the lines between different initiatives for which they are collecting signatures. It's easy to do, and frankly, it's a disservice to the general public. HB 36 would prevent intentional muddying of the waters. In conclusion, the statement was made this morning in previous testimony that the signature gatherers police themselves. I am not confident in this self-policing. Standards must be put in place to ensure a candid process, and we applaud the bill's author and co-sponsors for introducing the bill. This is one of the most important bills to my members and to the state of Alaska. I urge your support of HB 36. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Jason. I neglected to note that in attendance were Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramris, Representative Holmes, and Representative Dahlstrom has been excused today. And I will remind you that the failure of the cruise ship head tax bill was Lieutenant Governor Lauren Lehman, who failed to follow, in my opinion, the single subject issue, and in fact probably put about five different issues under the heading of the cruise ship. So that blame hardly can be put at the feet of the initiative people. The failure was in the construction and the authorization by the Lieutenant Governor of that bill, which has been destructive to the industry that I'm part of. But being familiar with the initiative process, I can tell you right where the failure was, and it wasn't on the streets. It was with the Lieutenant Governor's poor exercise of judgment, in my opinion. Representative Lynn has a question for you, Jason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned early on in your testimony just now my concern about contribution from foreign entities. Now, I'm a little confused the way you put that. Were you talking about Alaska residents who work for a foreign company, or are you talking about the foreign company directly making contributions to initiatives?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I think both. They work hand in hand, and the international companies that choose to invest in Alaska have vested interests in the process. And so I would say I apply that to both, Representative Lynn.
So now, if I may, Mr. Chair, so the foreign companies do directly invest, and some of their employees, both outside of Alaska and outside of the United States, for that matter, as well as those employees who may well be Alaska citizens, all three of these people concurrently contribute. Is that correct?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I believe that is the case, yes.
Yeah, I wish I'd work with my political campaign running for office here.
Okay, any other questions for Mr. Brennan? Jason, we thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
You're welcome. Let's next go to Janine St. John with the Alliance. Please, Janine, welcome to House Judiciary. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Janine St. John, and I'm the current president and testifying on behalf of the Alaska Support Industry Alliance in support of HB 36. My testimony is quite short today, and I appreciate my other cohorts who have testified today, and they've gotten into quite the detail, so I'll just keep it nice and short. The Alliance is a trade organization with more than 470 member companies, providing goods and services to Alaska's oil, gas, and mining industries. Our members provide more than 35,000 Alaska jobs. If you don't mind, I'd like to hesitate here for just a moment because I've been a member of the Alliance for, probably 20 years, and sometimes we just kind of glaze over this membership thing. But I just remember just a few years ago, we had around 300 member companies. So we've had a huge jump in folks that recognize the benefits of this alliance to the development of the oil and gas industry. So I just like to highlight that if you allow me.
Sure.
We do support the constitutional right of Alaskans to utilize the initiative process when they believe they are not being effectively represented. However, our members are quite concerned about the abusive use of the ballot initiative process. HB 36 will strengthen this process by ensuring the public is clearly aware of the true intent and the funding sources for any initiative. It's unfortunate that the initiative process has become a way for special interests to manipulate state law, and we very much appreciate Representative Johansson's, Representative Millett's, and Representative Wilson's efforts to amend the process and provide a truly open and transparent initiative process. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Janine? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony today. Can we go to Holly Hill with APOC, please?
Oh, Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Holly Hill, Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. We have no testimony, but are available if there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Holly? Representative Grunberg has a question for you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask a series of questions.
Do you care to dialogue?
Yeah, I'd like to. Yeah. Thank you. It will not be a monologue.
I betcha.
This bill did not go to House State Affairs as a sponsor substitute, and I just passed a note to the chair that I wish it had, because some of the questions I'm going to ask are really questions that we would have vetted in that committee. There are a number of technical things that this bill does, Ms. Hill.
If I may interject on that point, I never requested a bill to come to my committee, so this is on your own volition.
This is definitely on my own.
Volition.
I definitely had. Okay. looking at Section 2 of the bill, Ms. Hill, what is the effect of that amendment?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I'd like to have the Assistant Director, Chris Ellingson, address that question.
Maybe I should ask the rest of these to Ms. Ellingson, which is fine. So I will do that unless you want me to do differently. Ms. Ellingson, did you hear the question?
Could you please repeat it?
Yeah, I'm looking at Section 2 of the bill, and I'm going to ask this on a number of these because I don't fully understand them. They relate to 15.13 in general. What is the effect of Section 2?
As far as I can tell through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it will just require it just makes these people register, which they're already required to do, because 15.13.050 is the section that talks about people having to register as a group before they make an expenditure.
Okay. And Section 3?
065 talks about the sections of the law that apply specifically to the ballot issue process when this legislation was drafted, not the current legislation that you're looking at, but when AS 1513 was drafted. The Section 3 talks about 1513.065, and that's where the authority for the APOC to administer to ballot groups. It doesn't mean the limits go away and who can contribute to ballot groups. This is also where we, I believe, capture municipalities for their ballot questions.
Okay. I'm looking at Section 5 of the bill.
And, all right.
As I mentioned, I don't know if you were on the line when we talked this morning, subsection 2 does not make any sense to me. As the agency that will administer this, does Section 2, when read in context, make any sense to you? It reads to me, starting on line 27, page 2, this subsection applies to, and then number 2, require a report by a person, blah, blah, blah. Does that make any sense to you, or is there something that should be put in that's not there?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not sure. I get, this is a section that's kind of difficult for me because I have a hard time understanding why initiative is being pulled from referendum and recall. They're all kind of similar, and the reporting requirements are all the same. So I'm not sure I understand. It's just a repeat of what 110E is. It's just saying that the initiative people have to file their report as soon as they file with the Lieutenant Governor's office, and then they would be required to do their quarterly reports, which is what number 2 is talking about.
Okay. Now, we're dealing in the next section with, and in Section 7, and this is really to the heart of the stuff I want to talk to you about, I think. is these are general definitions. And what is the, I'm going to ask you the same question on both 6 and 7. What is the implication, full implication of changing the definition of, quote, contribution? How will that affect your entire interpretation and enforcement of 15.13?
The only thing that I can see through the chair, Representative Grunberg, is that this is, the changes are intended to ensure that reporting occurs earlier in the ballot process rather than, you know, later. I think currently it says at 30 days under 110E, and then with the definition of contribution and expenditures, again, they're talking about making it an earlier disclosure of when those contributions or expenditures would have to be disclosed. It shouldn't affect the nature of donations or spending, but you know, I don't know how it's going to be in practicality.
I'm going to call a brief at ease for a second. No problem. We've been joined by Representative Gatto some time ago. My mistake in not recognizing you, Representative Grunberg.
Just one final question. So, Ms. Ellingson, it's your interpretation of sections 6 and 7 that they are tied to section 1 of the bill.
Yeah.
Correct?
Through the chair, I'm not certain about that. I think section 1 is talking about when an individual makes a contribution, and then the definition of what a contribution is would be subject, you know, under 6 and 7.
Thank you. I gather you're confused and not able to really answer my question. But thank you very much.
Okay. We are going to go to Fairbanks, to Mr. Prax. When we do take up HB 36, we will invite APOC back to be available to answer specific questions about the initiative process, because I think that they would be uniquely helpful in this regard. So we're going to close public testimony, but we will loop back around to include APOC and any questions with the Department of Law as it relates to some constitutionality, both in the state constitution as well as the federal constitution. At this point, we're going to go to Mr. Prax, and then we're going to close public testimony. Mr. Prax?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Mike Prax. My address is 1015 Metairie, North Pole. And I don't know whether I'm in favor of or against HB 36. I guess I'm just, I do have some concerns. I haven't participated actively in the initiative process for quite a number of years, but my concerns are that the changes that already have been implemented, this just the business of gathering signatures from 30 different districts, has made the process much more difficult. And when I was involved, it was just more or less citizen-driven groups, not well-organized and all of that kind of thing. And I think they're pretty well an obsolete way of getting an initiative passed anymore. Getting at least gathering the signatures and whatnot, and we want to be careful that we're not going further than what is necessary, and in fact doing something that's a step backwards that makes it only accessible to the what I think are the targeted groups. They will be the only ones who'll be able to take advantage of the process. So I just want to caution you to be thinking about that in your work on this bill. And also the legislature currently has an opportunity to consider and hold public hearings on initiatives once they have been certified and placed on the ballot. There's a 2-year period, at any rate enough time for the legislature to get together in their sessions, and they can introduce that initiative, or if they pass something substantially similar, then the initiative becomes law. But the concern here is, I think, bills that would not pass the legislature. Well, in that case, they can still hear the bill and they can, let's say they hear it and decide that they're against it, well, that sends a strong statement to the public. Conversely, if you let the interest groups that are promoting the bill hold the public hearings, et cetera, it seems to me that that could very easily become just a perfunctory exercise and not provide the value that people are expecting. So I think there's some value in getting more transparency as far as the contributors, but I think we do have to be careful that we're not going too far with this and implementing some things that really aren't going to work out the way that we think they are today. Just that's all. That's my concern.
Thank you, Mike. Are there any questions for Mr. Prax? Mike, I don't see any. We do thank you for taking time out of your day. It's good to hear your voice, and I hope it's still springtime up there. It was beautiful yesterday.
Beautiful today.
Oh, perfect. We're glad to hear that.
It was beautiful when it was 50 below, too.
God bless you, Mike. You got a better imagination than I do, and I'm born and raised, so I get it. God bless you for that. Okay. We thank Mr. Prax for his testimony. At this point, unless there's anybody else in the room that wants to speak to HB 36, we're going to close public testimony. As I say, we will make APOC and the Department of Law available again as we go through this. Public testimony is closed. Now we're going to turn back to HB 9, and we're going to go through the amendment process on HB 9, and then pending the tolerance of the committee, we will... We'll very likely wind up the day on that and then be able to take up HB 36 on Wednesday.
Question.
Representative Holmes.
I had two or three quick questions for the bill drafter. Would you prefer that I take those today, or would you prefer that I hold those and do that
on
a different...
On which piece of legislation?
On HB 9.
On HB 9 for the bill drafter.
Yes, Jerry Luck. We'd been sort of rolling this for a while.
Okay. And is Mr. Luckup with us telephonically? Okay, so
he's,
we will.
I think sitting in his office awaiting our call.
Okay, great. We will put. Thank you very much, Sonia. We appreciate your flexibility today. We appreciate it. Okay, so we will endeavor to get Mr. Luckup on the line. Tom, we'll have you and Sue McLean come up here. And our intention is to go through committee discussion, the amendment process, and then hold off on a final vote until. Representative Dahlstrom can vote on the issue, which was the promise of the chair. Representative Grunberg, you have a concern?
No. We're on the E version.
My understanding is that we are on the E as an Eric version. That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. And so public testimony is closed. We are ready to take amendments. We have available the bill sponsor with Tom Wright. We have the Department of Law here with... Ms. McLean, Mr. Peoples is here in and out from Corrections. It's available. Doug Wolliver from Court System. And we're going to wait for Mr. Luckup. And Mr. Luckup is on his way. So so let me be clear, Representative Holmes. You have questions on the bill that you would like to take up before we go into the amendment process, or can we... take up our First Amendment, and then when Mr. Luckup gets here, does it...
it's probably okay if we fit him in. I think it's probably fine if you start with the amendments and we fit him in. I can be flexible, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I think if you took a look at E7, that may not be controversial.
And E.6, E.3.
Which one's that?
Okay.
So what about...
Okay.
Paramedic.
Oh. So we are going to label E.7 as amendment number one. And
let's see if I have these amendments.
There are three amendments, E.3, E.6, and E.7. So we have before us as amendment number one, E is an Eric.7. Are you with us, Susan?
Yes, sir. Sorry. I thought I had everything.
Is she getting some more amendments?
Okay. Yep.
I could read it into the record.
Okay, if you want to read it into the record.
It's page 15, line 11, following firefighter, and it just is one of the aggravating factors.
Maybe I have it.
Got it there?
Fire, I have it here, yes.
Okay. It just adds emergency medical technician, paramedics, ambulance attendants. Are you offering it, Mr. Chair?
I think it's mine.
Representative Gatto?
I think that was my amendment.
Oh, okay.
I'll just wait. Can you speak to it?
Yeah, Representative Gatto, do you want to move amendment number one?
I'll move amendment number one.
E.7 is amendment number one. Representative Gatto moves it. Representative Coghill objects for the purpose of discussion. Representative Gatto.
We very often talk about police and fire being protected, receiving a special level of protection. We also try to protect doctors and nurses, et cetera. But on any kind of emergency scene, you would be rare to have police and fire and not have the medics also.
Very good. Is the objection maintained?
No.
Representative Coghill removes the objection. Amendment number one passes. Bless you. I will offer E.6 as amendment number two.
Sorry, Chairman, I don't have an E.6. I have an E2, E3, and E7. Is there an E6?
E6 replaced
E2. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I had to have the outdated amendment.
E6 replaces.
Mine is dated 3/23/09.
Okay, I got it here. E.6 is number two. Okay.
Starts with page one, line four, following the first occurrence of rules.
Okay.
Is that the same amendment that the table is looking at? Is that right?
Yeah.
I've got it now, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Oh, it's this one.
Oh, it's E2.
Okay, so we like you very much. Ms. McLean, we like you. We didn't hear what you said. If it was off color, you're A-OK.
Mr. Chairman, not to be dilatory, Tom Rice, for the record, staff to the speaker. I have E2 dated 3/9. So this along the same lines that we're talking about?
No.
E9?
Yeah, let's call in at ease. I move amendment number two.
Object.
And Representative Holmes objects for the purpose of discussion. Who knows anything about E.6? Because I do not.
Jerry Luckoff.
Is this a Luckoff amendment?
Actually.
Do you know about?
I do know about this amendment.
Is it on discovery?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Ms. McLean, we're so happy to have you before committee. We like having you here. You're terrific. So if you will take us through amendment number two, E.6, please.
My name is Sue McLean. I represent the Department of, or I'm here on behalf of the Department of Law. Amendment E.6, the purpose of Amendment E.6 is to provide for reciprocal discovery 30 days before the penalty phase of a capital case. There is an exception, and that is that the rules pertaining to expert witnesses would remain the same as they are. Under the current rules, there is reciprocal discovery regarding expert witnesses. It's limited. The reason for this amendment is that with this bill, the court must allow, with any bill on capital punishment, the court must allow the jury to consider anything that is potentially mitigating. And what that amounts to sometimes is that witnesses can number in the hundreds. If a person is convicted, there is nothing wrong with, and it is fairly ordinary to hear from everyone who has known that individual from kindergarten on up. And the purpose of this really is to sort of speed the process along. This is obviously the penalty phase of a capital case is probably the most significant phase, and all both sides should be prepared to hear from the witnesses who are going to testify in the penalty phase. This is akin to our current criminal rule 32.1, which does require the defense to give notice of the evidence that it intends to produce in support of mitigating factors. And it is mitigating factors that we're talking about in the penalty phase. And, of course, the state also has to give notice of the evidence it's going to produce in aggravating, in support of aggravating factors. And this amendment provides for reciprocity in that arena. I have heard a couple of objections with regard to Scott, which is the case which says it is unconstitutional under our state constitution to require a defendant to provide any discovery with the exception of an expert witness if he plans to call the expert witness, he or she plans to call the expert witness at trial. And Scott prohibits, read literally, requiring a defendant to provide evidence which could bear on the question of the defendant's guilt. When we get to the penalty phase, the question of guilt has already been determined. We wouldn't be in the penalty phase if the question of guilt had not been determined. An argument could be raised that if you're requiring this evidence 30 days before the penalty phase, then the guilt phase is not over, and therefore you run the risk of requiring the defendant to present something that might bear on the defendant's guilt. I would simply tell this body that similar arguments have been made in California and Washington, which require reciprocal discovery in the penalty phase prior to the penalty phase, the similar argument being that the discovery is being made before guilt has been determined. I do want to say clearly that both of those states already have reciprocal discovery generally. But in those cases, what the courts have said is that if the defendant has some concern that what he's about to discover may bear on the issue of guilt, then the defendant can be heard ex parte in camera with the court, and the court can withhold some of that discovery, reserve ruling until the guilt phase is over. And if the court decides that the defendant's witnesses will come in, then the state would be entitled to a continuance in order to prepare to meet those witnesses. This is a practical amendment to just kind of move the case along so that you can get to the penalty phase with the state and the defense preparing for the witnesses that will hear in the penalty phase of the trial. As a practical matter, many of those witnesses will have nothing to do with guilt. They'll be speaking to the character of the defendant. There'll be people from his church. There'll be people from his Boy Scout troop or Girl Scout troop. And there is nothing that says that this amendment is unconstitutional. It does track Rule 32.1, and I would just finally close by saying, obviously, there is no case on point because we have never had capital punishment in Alaska.
Well done. Thank you for a very thorough explanation. Is the objection maintained?
Mr. Chairman, if I may speak briefly to the
sure.
objection. I am going to maintain my objection, and I am going to vote no, partly because for two reasons, both of which were addressed by Ms. McLean. I'm not convinced that this is going to be a constitutional amendment. I think it's probably going to be unconstitutional, and also because I'm worried about the 30 days with the same jury being seated for both the guilt and the penalty phase, and the 30 days coming, I'm afraid you're going to be not only requiring unconstitutional disclosure, but requiring it while they're still debating guilt or innocence. So I'm going to maintain my objection.
Okay. As the objection is maintained, Susan, will you take the roll, please, for amendment number 2, E.6. Representative Grunberg.
Looking at the Scott decision, which was followed in a case called State versus Somerville, which is at 948 P. Second, 469, from the Supreme Court of Alaska in 1998. In other words, for the intervening 24 years, there was nothing to change the Supreme Court's opinion on the subject, and there wasn't even a dissent in either case. I think that it's reading those cases too narrowly to say that it only applies prior to the issue of guilt or innocence. It would seem to me, particularly in a capital case, which may be the paradigm, hypothetical or factual situation, the most serious consequence may very well be if it's used or required. The waiver or the abrogation of that constitutional right in the penalty phase when the person may be put to death. I think that This is extremely serious, and I doubt whether the Supreme Court would change its mind just because guilt had already been established. I don't think our Supreme Court looks at things so technically. Other Supreme Courts on other coasts yet to be named might do so.
Thank you.
But I don't think ours would. And let me ask a question of Sue, if I may. Have you prepared a separate fiscal note, or are you prepared to talk about the additional costs that would result from the legal challenge to Amendment Number 2 standing by itself? How much are we going to cost the state in additional legal fees for the adoption of this amendment?
Concise answer, please, Ms. McLean.
I don't have a dollar amount. If I may briefly say, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Groomberg, realistically, if this bill passes, I think that the state's going to have to defend the whole bill as soon as someone intends to implement it. I think we all know that.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
Yes, sir.
Susan, will you please call the roll?
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Groomberg.
No.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Rammers.
Yes.
4 yes, 2 no.
So Amendment Number 2 passes. Mr. Luckup is here. Jerry, if you would come up and address some questions for Representative Holmes and some of the other members, and then we will return to Amendment Number 3 shortly thereafter. Jerry, it's a pleasure always to have you before the committee. We like having you here. Yeah, keep an eye on him. If he gets out of line, Tom, you know the hand signal.
Feeling's always mutual.
You know it is, Mr. Luckup. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
He may be called to save your life one day.
For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services.
Welcome, Mr. Luckup. Representative Holmes, we'd like to take you through the paces.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just I have three questions for Mr. Luckup, and I appreciate you being here. First is a question about our Murder One statute. As you know, with the exception, I think, of murder of an unborn child, the House Bill 9 basically takes our Murder One statute and makes it a capital punishment, capital offense. And I was wondering if you could briefly explain to us how broad our Murder One statute is compared to other how broad the capital offenses under this bill would be in comparison to other states.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, our Murder One statute's, you know, slightly different than some other states. You know, it sort of follows a model penal code concept, and then it goes slightly a little broader in that we combine both those murders that you think of as first degree murder with malice, those types of murders that exist in some states, with some other forms of murder where we have extreme indifference to human life and things like that. We, as a drafting matter, starting from the standpoint of taking our Murder One statute and then applying these aggravating factors to it, was the direction I received, and I think in some cases a common approach in some states, but not all states have a Murder One statute as broad as ours. You could pick out just the regular form of Murder One, which is the, if you wanted to narrow it at all, you could just pick out the, here, let me turn the page. We could pick out just 1141A1 or A1, which are those, you know, basically common murders, and then, you know, we've got a murder of a child as part of that, which is, you've got some of these extreme indifference children's crimes being included in other state statutes, even with the malice aforethought idea. But you could narrow it by picking out the forms of Murder One that you wanted to. For drafting matter for the Murder One, with the aggravating factors to, you know, so potentially every one of these is a murder, but you're not going to have the aggravating factor in every one. So I'm not sure I said a whole lot there, other than our murder one statute is much broader than the normal statute that people think of from other states, which is a murder with malice, a forethought.
May I proceed to question number two, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Question number two. Early, way back when we first heard the bill, there was discussion of this bill having some additional safeguards vis-a-vis bills, capital punishment bills in other states. With the exception of, obviously, you can add to or reduce the numbers of aggravators and mitigators, but sort of leaving that issue aside, are there any additional safeguards in this bill? We know that other states have had problems ending up with innocent people on death row. Are there additional safeguards in this bill that aren't found in other states?
Well, I'm not sure there are right now in the CS. We took out the beyond what I liked, what I called, or through the chair, Representative Holmes, we took out what I called the beyond a reasonable doubt standard due to issues the AG's office, I think, had with how to apply that. That was one recommendation, but no state uses that yet. But it's been one recommendation that the law professors and law review, and it's been discussed in treatises, to have a higher standard of proof. Putting in a requirement for some sort of DNA or some other evidence, I'm not sure that any state, there are several states that have proposed that, but I'm not sure any state has adopted that yet. But again, that was a recommendation of this Massachusetts commission that was appointed a number of years ago. We have the appeal going directly to the Supreme Court, which is pretty common in all the states, and it's a required review. I'm trying to think of what some of the other things were. This hasn't been occupying as much time for me lately as it did earlier in the session. The aggravators, the mitigators, it was about the finding or the right before that.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Oh, we added that this is the jury has to find that an aggravating factor, and the mitigating factors don't outweigh the aggravating factor, and that they had to find that death is the appropriate sentence. And that considers the idea of the California residual doubt question, and that the jury still has some issues. They can still say, even though the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating factors, we really don't want to impose the death penalty here. And that addresses the idea of the California residual doubt idea that's been caught. Well, it came up through court decisions and basically applies all the time. And that's something that the commentators have talked about quite a bit, to incorporate a residual doubt standard, that the jury can sit there and say, well, I'm just not comfortable with imposing death in this case. And so that was added, that the jury had to find that. I don't think that was in the original draft, though. That was added as the other things came out. And I'm not really sure what else is.
And my final question, Mr.
Yes,
Chairman,
yes.
is, thank you, is that other than a determination of legal insanity, which I believe is a fairly narrow, rigid finding, are there any other accommodations in the bill for mental illness?
Well, there's the finding of mental retardation through the chair, Representative Holmes, and that follows the Washington requirements, and which implements the U.S. Supreme Court decision from and I actually actually know when that decision was. Atkins v. Virginia, that ruled the execution of a mentally retarded defendant was unconstitutional. We also have the initial determinations of competency, and all those things are required, and we basically follow our current procedures for all of those, though. And also, before you execute someone, you have to make sure that they're competent. If the person becomes incompetent after conviction and after sentence, then you would, current case law is you can't execute that person. And there's a statute or a provision for inquiring into their competency.
Excuse me, was that you? May or may not?
May not.
Satisfied?
Can I ask one more? I think this is a two-word answer. The bill as drafted would actually allow the state to execute somebody who was underage, who was, say, 16 or 17 years, as drafted right now. Is that correct?
I didn't include a provision that says that it's that you cannot execute someone under the age of 18. And when I spoke here the last time, I've called up various members and or their staffs to tell them I misspoke about. I was thinking of something else. But
caused a lot of disappointment around this table.
it bothered me. I kept thinking about it. The case on the 18-year-olds was. I have it here somewhere.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've now given him the chance to clear the records.
Purge. Mr. Rucker, breathe and purge.
It doesn't provide that. As far as I know, that other states that have it haven't done it either. I've been looking through. There's been several states that have proposed to add that to their statutes, and for whatever reason, the states have not. It doesn't mean that the statute's unconstitutional. It just means you won't be able to apply it against those people because of this U.S. Supreme Court decision that would override everything. But I actually started looking around after that to see how many states have actually implemented. There was a couple states that already had that before the decision. They wouldn't allow the execution of a child. And the other states that I've found haven't. I don't want to say 100%, but they, you know, close to that amount have not changed their statutes to provide that statutory minimum.
Satisfactory?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I appreciate the indulgence.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Luckup, how about the mentally ill? Usually incompetency includes developmentally disabled and, in the legal term, infancy. How about the mentally ill, the incompetent? Can they be executed under the bill?
No. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, they cannot. And if they're unable to assist at their trial, then our normal procedures dealing with incompetency would control that.
I'm talking about if they can, they're fit to stand trial, but they're determined to be mentally ill, but not guilty by reason of insanity or guilty but mentally ill. Any of those people be executed?
If they're incompetent. Unable to appreciate their conduct, or basically, I think what the argument goes, if they're unable to understand why they're being executed, is based a simple way of saying it. They're unable to appreciate they're being executed because of, you know, this act, then you cannot execute that person.
Satisfied, Representative Grover?
Well, I'm satisfied with the answer, not with the result.
Thank you. Representative Gatto?
Just for clarification, I think what you said was, yeah, they're physically capable of showing up at the trial and sitting in the chair, but they've just killed 12 people. Are they mentally ill? Yeah. But are they accountable? Yes.
Okay.
Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, they could be, depending upon the application of our statutes dealing with competency to assist at trial.
Okay. Very good. Let's go back to amendment number three. If that's acceptable to the members, that would be E.3. I will offer that. This is the, thank you very much, Mr. Luckup. This is the Maryland amendment, the irrefutable evidence amendment. I move amendment number three.
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes objects. I will remind members that this is what amendment number three does and does not do. What it does do is it brings what Maryland coined an irrefutable evidence standard into the death penalty, requiring DNA that links the defendant to the act of murder, or a videotaped voluntary confession by the defendant to the murder, or a video recording that conclusively links the defendant to the murder. This was Maryland's compromise, who had the death penalty and was contemplating removing it. Now, what this bill does not do is the person who goes into a school or kills somebody working in the line of duty or some heinous first-degree murder crime, and if one of these three standards is not present, then the state would not be able to pursue a death penalty. So that's what it does and what it doesn't do. Is that reasonably accurate, Ms. McClain?
Mr. Honor, or excuse me, through the yes, Mr. Chairman, that's reasonably accurate. It will not cover those cases in which there is a mass murder and no DNA or videotape or confession exists.
And I didn't ask, was there an objection? You objected, right? Okay, thank you. So is there a discussion about amendment number three? Is the objection maintained?
I was going to...
Discussion? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I appreciate, I think, the intent behind it, which is to try to be as infallible as possible. I'm going to maintain my objection and probably vote against this amendment because I think that it gives us sort of a false sense of security. I think we've heard testimony throughout, and we heard testimony, I think, from the Department of Public Safety earlier in the year about some problems with some of the DNA evidence. We've heard about some of the problems with even voluntary confessions and the videotape that conclusively links the defendant to the murder. I still think that there might be some issues there. So although I think that this bill, this amendment is an attempt to narrow it and to cut out the error, I believe, like I said, it would be a false sense of security.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion on amendment number three? Do you care to offer any? It's not necessary. Do you care to? Ms. McClain?
Mr. Chairman, the one suggestion that the Department of Law had made was that if this committee is going to pass amendment number three, we would suggest that biological evidence be defined, and we had given you a proposed definition of biological evidence.
I have that somewhere. I can't find it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Do you know where that is, Jane, the definition? Is that a copy of it right there?
You could take a moment, Mr. Chair. I got it here somewhere.
You have it right there. We'll make a copy of it. We'll take just a brief at ease. Have a definition, and I'm going to offer this as the amendment to amendment number three. Is there an objection to incorporating the definition that from the page it says from SB 110? Is that okay for you, Susan?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object just for 2 seconds to read it.
So Representative Holmes objects the amendment to the amendment.
I can remove.
Okay, the objection is removed from the amendment to the amendment.
Yeah, I'll object for the purpose of questions.
On the amendment to the amendment.
Right.
On the definition.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, the objection is maintained. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Biological evidence means, quote, the contents of a sexual assault forensic examination kit. I don't know what that means. That might just be a glove. That you have a glove or something in there. Doesn't get me very far along the inquiry. Ms. McClain, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have in Title 18 statutes pertaining to sexual assault examination kits, so that is a term of art. Sexual assault examination kit is actually designed by the Department of Public Safety as a specific meeting, and it includes all of the materials to gather DNA and hair and fiber evidence from a sexual assault suspect, and or a sexual assault victim. So I'm sorry, I don't have it's in Title 18, but it does have a meaning.
If I may dialogue permit, please. Now, is the content the evidence itself or the equipment that used to gather the evidence?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the equipment that is used to gather the evidence is then where the evidence resides, because if it's on swabs, we would save the swabs.
I see. Thank well,
you. Can I go to Representative Gatto, please? Can I go to Representative Gatto, please?
Just for clarification, if we took out the word means and put the word includes, then I think we have the better meaning of what we're talking about.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, our concern was that not that it with that definition, biological evidence would include these, but it would also include trees, food, animals. And so our concern was that it be narrowed to what it is that we're really looking for.
Thank you. Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. Ms. McClain, I think a technical amendment needs to be here. You want to have it mean both A and B, because I was reading it as or. Don't you mean that the evidence... No, because otherwise, if you simply have the kit itself but no evidence, it would satisfy that. Don't you mean it? And
the kit itself, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the kit itself, I have been through this a few times with this particular amendment, the kit itself, once it takes on this form of being a term of art of a kit, contains the biological evidence. So you don't have the gloves in there, you have the swabs in there, you have papers, you have the kind of thing that a criminal defendant would want to have preserved. I think that's the best way to put it. Anything that might have DNA from either the criminal defendant or from the victim, depending on which kit you have, would be in the kit, and so this word kit really does have a term of art meaning.
I understand. I'm just wondering, should there be some kind of a either conjunctive or disjunctive in there?
No.
Just as a drafting.
Representative Gruenberg.
Representative
Gruenberg.
It's important that we know whether it's and or. Otherwise, it's unclear to me. I don't know. Is there anybody else? Do you feel it?
I'm fine.
You're on your own expedition.
I'm just wondering, is it unclear? Do you mean and or something else?
Ms. McClain.
Through the chair, I think the intent here is to have it be an and or.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well,
Is the objection maintained?
No, I'm not going to object as long as it's clear.
Thank you. The objection is removed. The amendment to amendment is passed. We're back to amendment number 3 is before us. Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Susan, will you please take the roll on amendment number 3?
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Rammers.
Yes.
4 yes, 2 no.
All right, so with a four to two vote, amendment number 3 passes. Are there any more amendments at the table? All right, that brings the bill HB9 back before us. At this point, we're going to close for the day. Sue, I want to thank you and Mr. Wolliver and Mr. Peoples, and we are painfully aware of how many hours were spent on deliberating on this issue, and I don't believe that it will be necessary for you to attend to what will be a committee discussion on the final disposition of this bill as we discharge it from the Judiciary Committee. We will take up that final discussion on Wednesday when we convene again, along with other scheduled bills. We thank the indulgence of the committee. It's 3:30. Mr. Sabodny is walking in. Does he have anything to add? Mr. Sabodny, we've been waiting for you.
Uh-huh.
Not so. At 3:30, we are adjourned for the day.